Hi everyone, welcome to Oscar Wilde After Dark, a bonus series where we discuss the wilder side of Oscar nominees and winners. I'm Nick Werkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we have an exciting episode. I cannot wait. In the words of Cassandra Webb, I've been having visions. I knew he was going to die. Mother Superiorum herself is our centerpiece for today's episode. And it really is a part of our frequent collaborators' journey and series, because we are talking about two of Dakota Johnson's films, but also two of Tilda Swinton's films and two of Luca Guadagnino's films. So they have all worked together multiple times. I love them all. And those films that we'll be talking about include Suspiria, the remake from 2018, and A Bigger Splash. These really are two of our modern day witches, I will say. And I feel like these films have a lot more in common than I expected going in, because there are very mysterious things that happen along the way. So I'm excited to chat about these. How do you feel about our selection today?
What an introduction. I should have known that you would invoke Madame Webb, who I think is really our fourth key witch, if we're thinking about the witches in Suspiria. She is an everlasting presence in the same way that Mother Suspiriorum is. So I love that. I'm really excited to talk about both of these movies today because, first, I think Dakota Johnson, she is really having a big year. She just had her film Splitsville premiere at Cannes. She has Materialists coming out next week in theaters, which is Celine Song's follow-up to Past Lives. And I think she really is becoming a movie star. But these are two of her earlier works and some of her best works, too. I think Luca Guadagnino, as a director, really understands her and knows how to use her. And Suspiria, in particular, I think was really a moment in the culture. And I had a great time revisiting it. And A Bigger Splash, I think, is just a great summer movie. So I'm excited to talk about their collaborations through these two films. But then also, I mean, as long as I've known you, we've both been obsessed with Tilda Swinton. I feel like she was actually like one of the first people that we talked about when we met in college, of just being a key figure for us. And at that point, these movies hadn't even come out yet. So she was on our radar. We were already obsessed. And I continue to be even more so when I rewatch these films. So excited to talk about her too. But Luca also has a new film coming out this year called After the Hunt, which stars Julia Roberts, Iowa Debris, and Andrew Garfield. And I know we talked about this on our 2025 movie preview special, but are you excited for Materialists and After the Hunt? Are these highly anticipated movies for you?
Absolutely. I think Materialist more so, just because of how deeply moved I was by Past Lives. So that is just at the top of my list. After the Hunt is as well. Guadagnino, I think, is going to deliver us something potentially we haven't seen before from him, kind of like Queer, because I also don't really know what to expect from this. I've heard rave things. Who knows what kind of source that is coming from, but that collection of actors is also something I would have never expected, especially in a film by him. So I am definitely excited. That will be a fall release, which I think adds to the excitement of an award season release. Which one are you more excited about?
That's really hard to decide. I think with Materialists, I've become more excited for this as I've seen the marketing for the movie, which is giving strong 2007, 2008 vibes. It is taking me back to when I was in high school and those types of romantic comedies or romantic dramas that I really liked, from the poster to the trailer. There was that great riff on a MasterCard ad in a trailer that just came out recently. So I think I'm just excited for that as a good summer movie. And like you, I really loved Past Lives, so I'm excited to see what she does next. And then with After the Hunt, I probably am a little bit more excited even for this one, just because I love Julia Roberts, and the premise sounds great. It's about this woman who is a college professor, and she starts to come undone. There's a little bit of a scandal, and it's been compared to Tar. So if anyone is comparing any movie to Tar, sign me up. So I'm really, really excited for that. But both of these, I think, are definitely on my radar. And I think with Dakota Johnson, us, you know, choosing her as a subject, I wanted to start with this question for you, because this was just something that popped into my head as I was watching this. She's not an influencer, but she influences me in my style choices, my hair, my makeup. I've gotten lipstick shades that she has before. And I think a signature part of her look is her hair. It's this long, dark hair with her bangs. And in Suspiria, she has long red hair. And in A Bigger Splash, she's blonde. So how weird was it for you to see her forehead in both of these movies and a different hair color? Because I think it's become her signature. Now, to me, she is like Diane Keaton, where she just shows up to a set in her own clothes with her vibe that she has from her everyday life, and that's what the movie is going to look like. So I think it's a little odd to see her with a totally different look here.
I mean, even in Madame Web, when she has those high-waisted jeans, that feels like Dakota Johnson. And the red coat, it's a signature look from the movie, but it's also so indebted to her, I would say. The hair color really threw me off, because I also watched them in this order and she gets younger and younger. But the fact that I had to Google Dakota Johnson forehead was a whole thing I didn't expect to ever have to do, because I also thought it was the wig. And like, you know, it's this mysterious 1970s Berlin feature. I don't know what Luca was thinking, but I'm like, also because when I watched it, the still that shows up is her in a close-up, and it's really, you know, her hair pulled back.
It's severe.
And she has no bangs. Yeah. I'm curious what her with ginger bangs would have looked like. But it was a bit jarring. It was, but I think it added to the pieces themselves.
Yeah. And I mean, even though her look that we've come to expect, I think, and that we love, even though that's not here in these two movies, like I said at the beginning, I think Luca Guadagnino really understands her as an actress. I think one of my favorite qualities about Dakota Johnson is just how aloof she seems. That's why I really loved her in Madame Web too, because I feel like she knew how silly that was. And I think here he plays with that to some degree. I think more so in A Bigger Splash. I think she kind of wields that as a weapon a little bit. And then in Suspiria, I think playing this, you know, what first appears to be this innocent girl who is just like an eager student at the academy, and then we start to see her purpose and the layers really show themselves throughout that movie. I think he really understands her, and she and Tilda Swinton in particular play off of each other very well.
Yeah, I think these are both great enigmatic performances by Dakota, and it really shows how she's refined her acting over the years. Let's get right into Suspiria, and we can talk more about her and her roles. But description here: a darkness swirls at the center of a world-renowned dance company, one that will engulf the artistic director, an ambitious young dancer, and a grieving psychotherapist. Some will succumb to the nightmare, others will finally wake up. This is directed by Luca Guadagnino, stars Tilda Swinton, Dakota Johnson, Mia Goth, Chloe Grace Moretz, Angela Winkler, and more. Notably, during the press run for this movie, Tilda was credited as Madame Blanc. There was this other actor named Lutz Ebersdorf that they had written this history for, that the actors spoke of him being such an inspiration and a model for their acting in this movie. And, you know, people would ask like, oh, is this Tilda with prosthetic work? And she flatly denied it. Luca denied it. And not until the release did she finally come out and say, this was me. So I love that this whole thing was a ruse that she had played three different characters and was fronting as this other guy the entire time. So again, this is why we love Tilda. She is a chameleon. She can do anything. And I think is also a good contrast to what she can do in A Bigger Splash. Awards for this movie. It won 2 Indie Spirits for Best Cinematography for Sayambu Mukdiprom and the Robert Altman Ensemble Award. It won at the Venice Film Festival for Original Song for York, the song A Suspirium. It also won multiple regional prizes throughout the award season. And then it also won special effects for Franco Ragusa. And then it was also nominated at the Grammys for Best Song Written for Visual Media for York, that same song. In terms of Oscar connections, so people in the production that have been nominated or have won Oscars before, Tilda Swinton, she won Supporting Actress for Michael Clayton. Luca was nominated for Best Picture for Call Me By Your Name. Marc Coulier won 3 Oscars for Makeup and Hairstyling for The Iron Lady, The Grand Budapest Hotel, and Poor Things, and he had 2 other nominations. Lars Ginzel, who is the re-recording mixer, and Frank Kruis, who is the supervising sound editor and sound designer. They were both nominated for sound for All Quiet on the Western Front. And then last but not least, we had Manolo Garcia, the hair creator, who was nominated for makeup for The Sea Inside. So talking about Suspiria, we have to mention the original by Dario Argento in the 70s. What do you think of this as an adaptation? What did you think of this film on its own? And then having seen it back in 2018 and rewatching it at least now, or have you multiple times since then?
So oddly, this was my first time rewatching it since I saw it in 2018. But when I saw it in theaters then, I loved it. I love a film set in Berlin. And I think with these actresses, if a dance academy is run by a coven and Tilda Swinton is running that coven in some way, sign me up. It's so for me. Mm-hmm. I think when I think of Dario Argento's film, that of course is this well-regarded work of giallo horror. And I think of bright colors. I think of the reds and the purples and the greens and just how vivid it is. And when I think of Luca's Suspiria, I think of browns and beige and these very muted tones. It reminds me a lot of how I feel watching Nicholas Roeg's version of The Witches, one of my favorite films. And also a little bit of Don't Look Now and some of those colors that we see in Venice. We do get the vivid red here, but it doesn't come until later, which I think is what makes it really pop. But I think, you know, this film is also an hour longer than Dario Argento's film. And in that, I think it can become a bit convoluted in some ways. I think it can be a bit perplexing as you're watching this and taking it all in. But I also think that part of that, what I like about that is that we get interesting tidbits of Susie's character. And we feel the power that she has through the film in a different way than we do with our protagonist in Dario Argento's version. And I like that as the film progresses, we don't just feel like she is this eager, wide-eyed dance student, but that she sought them out. She is there for a greater purpose. And I find that very empowering. I really like what they do with that character. And it's not just because she's from Ohio. She's our Midwest girl who has found another life for herself. But yeah, I think overall, though, I really enjoy it. And I like all of the extraneous details that he throws in. It's not a perfectly clean and tightly constructed film, but I think I like it for how unwieldy it can be. And I want to say, too, this film, at one point in time, was meant to be directed by David Gordon Green. And we really dodged a bullet there. You know how I feel about David Gordon Green's horror films.
Oh, yeah.
Exorcist Believer, some of his Halloween entries. So I'm very happy that this is the version we got.
And the fact that his Halloween came out that same year, I didn't even realize. But I'm curious if this would have been different than a lot of what his recent films have been. I first saw this film at the Cinerama Dome in LA at the premiere, and Luca was there.
Oh my God.
Dakota was in this. Yeah. Dakota was wearing this really bright red dress, and Tilda had some similar colored pants on. So yeah, that was a spectacle to say the least. I wasn't super high on the final act of the movie, I would say, at the time. I feel like it went a little bit off the rails, but I also hadn't rewatched this since then, and I think my recent viewing was a bit better. I love the vibe of the movie, the fact mm-hmm. that it's different from Argento's Giallo. And Argento wasn't a fan of it. He and Guadagnino are friends, and he told him that he was upset with how he had remade the film and that it was different, but I really do like the bleak, wintry vibe and the faded, muted colors, because it really does. Once you get to the end, you have all of these pops of red showing up in small ways, and then as it builds and builds, and then you finally get the red frames at the end and just all of the blood. I was definitely a bit higher on it this time than I was previously, but 1970s Berlin, recalling how the witches had to go into hiding a little bit during World mm-hmm. War II or after the war, and relating that to Nazi persecution in a way, but really just being absorbed by the mysticism at the center, the importance of femininity and identity of these dancers and of the mothers, and how they treat people who don't either believe in them, or what they end up doing to people who want to expose them, including the doctor, including Patricia, including Sarah. And again, I love seeing Tilda in all of these other roles with prosthetics. The first time I saw this, I had no idea any of them were Tilda. And I was so shocked, but now I could see it. And I still think her acting is phenomenal in that she masks herself in a way between these other characters. So we have the doctor, Dr. Klemperer, Helena Marcos, who we see at the end, and then Madame Blanc obviously is her with her long black hair pulled back in a ponytail, very stoic, and she leads the company with such ease. So I think there's a lot to get into too with the effects, like we talked about with Marc Coulier, or different scenes. There are a lot of great climactic moments. I know you're a fan of Radiohead. How did you feel about the score and the music in this film? Because it is very different to Argento's, who also complained that there wasn't music in the movie. And I disagree with that, because I like the feeling of this music adding to the entire energy of the film.
I'm obsessed with the music. I actually have fall and winter playlists with this score and the original song on them. And if I'm around other people, it's usually a skip, because it gets a little, it's a little weird.
Weird.
But no, this would have been my original score winner of that year. I think the music really aids in creating this cold, dark, unsettling vibe that you talked about. This is a movie, I think, like Luca's other movies, that really, I think, depends on the mood that he's created. And here, I think the score does so much, especially as it starts and we get the credits. It feels like the music is really transporting you back to 1977 Germany. And I think I like, though, that it isn't incredibly music heavy during some of the dances, like during the performances, because I like that you can hear their bodies instead and how intense and aggressive these dances are. And it's not overpowered by music, like I think you see in some films about dance. Here, it's really hearing their breathing, their sighing. And in, I think, a scene that a lot of people think of in this movie, they're in a rehearsal scene and Susie, she steps up to perform one of the, key parts of Volk, of this dance. And Olga, a student who is pretty concerned about this disappearance of Patricia, this former student, she gets trapped in this parallel room with all these mirrors around her. And as Susie's dancing, her movements, the way she's moving her arms and her legs, are affecting Olga in the next room. It's like this spell. And I think the sound work there, if we had too much score, it would be drowned out and you wouldn't hear her bones breaking. And it's pretty gross. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very graphic, brutal scene as her face is practically, you know, melting off. And then later we have my favorite sound effect in the film, which I think is absolutely vile and horrifying. Those hooks that they have to pierce her skin. Oh my God. When I watched it again, I was like, okay, please, can we be done with the hooks? How many hooks are they going to put in her body? Because that sound as they raise the hook and then as they lower it into her body, that kind of whoosh of the metal and then the puncture, it's so visceral. And I think you would miss that if you were too dependent on classical music or a score.
I love the sound design in this movie. And the fact that we mentioned some people on the sound team earlier, I think shows that because, yeah, you have all of these effects that add to the reality of the moment. And I think that grounds it in something that in this world may not feel as real. So you have the hooks. I love the bones breaking in a way. You know, you see her jaw nearly being pulled off from the side. With that, you hear the mothers counting, you hear the metronome, you hear their feet stomping, and that gives an energy to them as a collective, which this movie is also getting at. I think, you know, with Tilda portraying multiple people, you feel this interconnectedness between the mothers of motherhood. And as Dakota's character rises, you start to feel her being more entwined in that as well. And that relates to the costumes, and especially during their final dance when they're trying to actually conjure up this demon or the other mother. Again, things kind of get a little hazy for me towards the end, but the pattern, that really bright red, are just intertwined around their bodies, almost like they were roped around them in certain strict angles. And then you have the stars on the floor. So it's everything working together, the camera work, you get to see these montages of sometimes gross images. There's a worm at one point, there are skeletons you see, and then also this shining of the walls that relates to their powers. And that also made me think of The Shining, obviously. But you see them in Susie's hands when Madame Blanc gives her the power during her dances. There are a lot of great movements, I think, with this film. The editing and the dancing, that feels like a spell in and of itself.
Yes, I love the editing. I love the way that those, frankly, terrifying images are incorporated. And these girls, and Susie in particular, start having nightmares. And the actions of this coven, of these witches who are leading them and manipulating them, are affecting them in their sleep too. I really like that. And I think, again, I continue to just be obsessed with Tilda Swinton and her look and entire energy as Madame Blanc. I'm surprised I did not dress up as her for Halloween. Honestly, it might have been the timing of the movie, but when she's just sitting there in those turtlenecks or just the way she's walking around, it is so frightening, but she is so cool that I just think every time, if I went to this dance academy, I would do everything to impress her. I would want to follow her. I think she has that kind of aura and this power and how she pulls people in, and specifically the girls. And one of my favorite things also about the movie is when the older members of the coven have meetings away from the girls. I think it's really unsettling and scary. Like when they are kind of back in their quarters and they're all sitting around the table and they hold that vote for who should be the leader of the coven, Madame Blanc or Mother Marcos, or when they're just sitting around the dinner table later on, there is just this feeling that I think you're watching something that feels actually really evil. And I really like when horror films do that. And in particular there, what I really loved learning about this movie is that the costume designer, she was actually inspired by Rosemary's Baby, which, as you know, is my favorite horror movie. But thinking of how she could create these women that were really similar to how you might feel about Ruth Gordon when you're watching that movie in terms of costume and color and how they interact with these girls. They seem, you know, very helpful or unassuming at first. And then you realize they actually are serving something that is much more evil than what you would come to expect. So I really, really like those scenes too. I think that Mia Goth and Dakota Johnson are really good, in particular, as these younger dancers, and they're good, I think, vessel for the audience, especially as Sarah, the Mia Goth character, is speaking with Dr. Klemperer and trying to get a better understanding of what's happened. You know, she's in the bowels of the dance academy in some scenes, you know, going into the catacombs. That's really freaky. But for me, it really is, unsurprisingly, all about the older women as part of this coven. I think they're just fascinating to watch.
Well, some of my favorite moments obviously come from Madame Blanc, who, after Susie does her first dance in front of the company, so not the official one, but this is the Olga dance scene when she's being disfigured. Madame Blanc says, "Oh, you're sick. You fell to the floor. That's not where the dance ends." She's very straight with her in a very German way. And she's like, "No, I didn't fall. I didn't want to throw up in your studio." And later on, after she is rested, she goes to Blanc's office and she goes, "You don't look better. Or are you this pale all the time?" And I'm like, oh my God, she is ruthless.
That's where we get that great split diopter too. I love that shot.
So I totally agree that, you know, the mothers are so disturbing. And every time we're back there, it feels like we shouldn't be. Like when they're at the dinner table and the one mother just stabs herself in the neck with a knife. And it's so fast. And everyone is shocked. But again, it's just before that happens, you feel like you're on edge. And another moment I love is when Susie and Sarah are trying to find Olga's file and Patricia's file, and they're sneaking in the office, and Susie goes in the back and she just watches the mothers hex these policemen, and they pull their pants down. They're like playing with them with that scepter, but she just looks through the bookcases and she goes back to Sarah, doesn't say anything. So it feels like in that moment, there is some sort of transformation happening, because she doesn't react how I would have expected her. Like, she wasn't scared, she was laughing, and then just left. So I think all of them are fantastic. Mia, especially towards the end when she breaks her leg and they put a spell over her and she ends up dancing again. Great effects work, makeup, so gruesome. And then towards the end, we see more of Dr. Klemperer, and they confuse him into thinking Anka has come back. I think this is like the most heartbreaking moment of the film. And it plays with this other quote that I love. And they say, "Love and manipulation, they are frequent bedfellows." And so they are manipulating him. But in the end, it's his love for Anka that has really saved him. And he was on her mind in her final moments after being sent to a concentration camp and really freezing to death, which again is gruesome and violent. And he brings it back in a way that there's still some hope, which, of all of the things that happen in this movie, again, totally unexpected, especially with the amount of blood we see in that nearly final sequence.
I love that final sequence and really the ending of this film and that final act, which I agree does go off the rails, but I think is a really interesting pivot from what Argento does in his ending of having Susie kill Mother Marcos. But here, the fact that Susie is actually a vessel for Mother Suspiriorum is, I think, just such a cool detail, and one that I love throughout the film. When you watch back, you can start to see traces of that in her interest in the dance academy and the way that she communicates with Madame Blanc. I love when they're just communicating telepathically. I think that's really cool. And I get the same feeling, actually, when I watched this that I had when I watched the ending of Midsommar, which is that I just feel I shouldn't be happy after all of the violence and all of the horror that I've just witnessed. But you can't help but just feel comforted that the rightful thing has happened for these women at the center. And they're kind of at the peak of their powers and have pushed aside all of this nonsense and pain of their past and kind of come into their true form. So I don't know. That's when I was talking about it feeling empowering at the beginning. That's the part where it feels that way for me, which might be a disturbing read to some, but not to me.
Well, and then it continues. They just go on dancing and that's that. So yeah, it's an interesting ending and I think is a great accompaniment to the original. Well, that was our preview of our After Dark episode on Suspiria. Go to patreon.com/OscarWilde and subscribe at the After Dark tier or higher for our full analysis of the film. We still have a little bit to talk about, and then we'll also be discussing a bigger splash. We have previous episodes from everything from Ma to Freaky Friday.
Everything with our Oscar nominees and winners that would never actually be recognized by the Academy, that's what we talk about on Patreon.
More fun. So yeah, I recommend checking that out. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to also rate, review, and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and TikTok. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll have another episode in our frequent cinematic collaborator series. This is our second episode, and we'll be talking about the relationship between Steven Spielberg and John Williams, who are both beloved by the Academy in wins and nominations. And we will be having a little celebration of Jaws having its 50th anniversary, notably one of the first summer blockbusters ever. So we'll be talking about that and many of their other films.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. I think that'll be a perfect summer episode. Until then, thanks everyone. We'll see you next time.